Welcome back. I'm Gary Parr.
I'm Christine Williams.
And you're listening to Fiber Talk. We do it twice a week. It's for people who play with needles.
Indeed.
And this week, we're really excited to have, I say that every week, don't I, that we're really excited to have someone.
Yeah, kind of.
Yeah. I may have to find a different approach but we are. We're excited.
Feeling a bit scared.
Yeah. Lorna Bateman. Lorna Bateman is with us. Hi, Lorna.
Hi there, Gary. Hi, Christine.
Hello. Welcome.
Lorna, embroiderer, silk ribbon stitching, stump work, and we caught her between trips to France, teaching trips to France. So we snagged her in the week here where she's actually at home and get to talk to her. So really appreciate that.
Thank you. No, that's an absolute pleasure. Nice to be on part of your show. This is very new for me, obviously. I've never done anything like this before. So I look forward to being interviewed by you both.
Always good to test the frontiers here, Lorna. It's good for you.
Well, I hope I'm going to teach you something today as well.
Counting on that. Yeah. So we were, before we started, you had a storm go through and you were concerned that the power was going to go out and said you were stuck in the studio. So let's just start out. What kind of a situation do you have? You have a separate studio building where you can work and leave all your stuff laying out, or how does that work for you?
Yes. Yeah, I do. Last year, last summer, in fact, it's just on a year ago now, we built a studio at the end of the garden. There was an old shed at the bottom of the garden, which was literally falling down. So we used the same footprint area, enlarged it slightly, and put up a proper wooden construction, which is fully insulated, waterproof, obviously, lovely space. And I look out onto the fields behind us because we live in a small village in the country. It's my little hideaway. It's quite a big room. It's about, talking in meters, I think it's 6.5 meters by 3.5 meters. So it's a fair size.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And we run our entire operation from this room. So I teach in it when I do, not very often, but small groups. Four or five in a group, so it's more one-on-one tuition. Then we pack, I run, as you probably know, a mail order kit business, and we pack all the kits in here, get everything ready. We do everything from A to Z in the studio, so I'm very fortunate.
Lots of windows, lots of light?
Yes, we've two windows. One fairly large, so virtually the one length of, half the length of one side, and the other one's a small window on the side, and then we have a skylight as well to allow maximum light from the top. But the actual room itself is also well lit with LED tube lighting, the full length, so not fluorescent as in the old traditional fluorescent. They look like fluorescent bulbs to lights to a certain extent, but they actually have LED lights in them, so that the light from them is very, very good to work under.
I
think we're both going the same direction. What color LED lights do you use? Because in my workspace, I have something that's a daylight that's almost tends towards the blue.
Yes.
That's very much not like what you would normally find in a house, which is a little bit more on the soft white side, which is, you know, so Gary and I from our old world would talk about Kelvins. The softer light, the yellower, more flattering to skin tones light is like 2400 Kelvin. And the light that I'm using in my living room, just because it's my work area too, is upwards of 6500 Kelvin. And sometimes people who are very picky will come in and say, this room is too blue. It's too bright. You know, it doesn't look like a living room. So what kind of light color?
It's tending more towards white light, but it's soft. It's not a harsh light at all. In fact, it's when it is overcast, it's like being in a room that has natural light in it. I know the blue bulbs you're referring to are the ones that I do have one of them to use in a lamp. I haven't used it actually for a long time, but I do have one specifically for embroidery, one of the blue bulbs you're talking about. Mm-hmm. But I didn't sort of put the lights in specifically for embroidery. I just got the electrician in and asked him for the best, explained to him what we were doing, and which light would work best. And he said this was the most natural, closest to daylight.
Yes, right. So that's pretty much what I have in it. Yeah, I guess it's just not what people typically use in a living space, but for a workspace, it makes sense.
Oh yeah, I mean, I wouldn't want this in the house. It's you know, the entire room is very well lit up. In the house, we mm-hmm. like soft lighting and side lighting as opposed to overhead lighting anyway.
Right.
Yep. So.
Well, that's. Yeah, I'm jealous. That a space like that, that's just fantastic. Yeah.
Oh, I'll send a picture. What I'll do is I'll take a good picture and I'll pop a picture across to you, and then you can see what I mean about the space.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
We have already outgrown it, I might need to add. We sort of emptied about three rooms into the house, came into the studio, and the idea was I'd move out totally. But the business has grown so much that I still occupy a full room in the house as well. So all the bolts of fabric are stored in the house. Spare backup stock is stored in the house. So I still encroach on the house. Yeah.
So you must have, I mean, you have to store a lot of materials, inventory for your classes and for your kits. So it must be between your house and your studio, some length of effort to properly store things so there's no deterioration. I mean,
No, we're well packed and very well organized. I've been packing kits now since 2002. So, over time, as the business has grown, you devise ways, making it work for you. So an actual design, each individual design is stored in a box, a file box, and we've got them stored all along underneath the countertop with the name on the front. And that will have the details, the requirements for that particular design in it. It has component parts in it, instructions, threads, whatever is needed for that particular design. Then when we make them up, obviously we can't store them all in that small box. We make up the kits, and then they are packed in what I think is found in the US as well, a line of boxes called Tough Crates, mm-hmm. which are fabulous storage boxes. They come in all sorts of sizes, and we've got fairly big ones, 64 liters, that fit under the countertop. And we've got them then filed. The kits are then filed under silk ribbon, stump work, creative embroidery, crazy patch, or whatever it is, different boxes for them. And behind each file divider will be the kits will be stored. So say, for example, if it's a pincushion kit, a sheep pincushion kit, there'll be 20 kits packed in stock, ready to go. Wow. We sort of, depending on how popular a design is, we will have anything from 5 to 20 kits packed, not in their final outside bags, but in the cellophane bag with the component parts. So that when somebody places an order, then we just pop the cellophane bag into the yellow bag, and then obviously into a box and post it.
Hmm. So, yeah, so a system then. You have two or three people working with you all the time?
Not all the time, because this is where the difficulty lies. My studio is obviously my working space, and I can't create and stitch and design if I have people around me. I like working on my own. So I have two people that help, sometimes three, just depending on who I need to call in. One of the ladies that helps, Elizabeth, she comes in, she packs all the kits, she does all the orders, usually 2 days a week. And then my sister's my boss. She does all the very bossy. She's an accountant, always trained as one. So she takes, she does the business side for me, which is just fantastic. She does all my books. She does paperwork. She does the pricing. You know, week in and week out, she keeps her fingers on things. And then she lives about an hour away from me. So she drives up once a week and then, she takes work back with her and does it at home when she can fit it into her schedule. So yeah, two people that work for me. And I've got another friend who sometimes helps with design, with ideas. She's a designer herself, and she helps with design ideas that I have and implementing them, like, for example, a bag or whatever. She's trained in pattern cutting.
Oh, okay.
So, but for the most part, it's Helen and Elizabeth and myself at
my,
the moment.
My sister's my boss. Oh, boy.
Well, she'll laugh when she hears this, but it's perfectly true. she's absolutely excellent at what she does. And I'm hopeless with figures and paperwork. So she said, if you want me to get you into shape, you've got to listen to what I say.
Oh, here we go. Here we go. Buckle up.
Well, she said, you can't, you know, principle and what she is working and where she's coming from is that if you want to do this for a living, you have to price things accordingly. And she feels, she just felt I wasn't able to make a living from it because I wasn't charging enough. So we've concentrated on producing a top quality product, so that people are getting absolutely everything they need in the kit to take with them. Other than an embroidery hoop, they can pick up one of my designs and just take it with them on holiday, for example. And that's that, you know, that's the end to which we work. And it's, I mean, she's been a fantastic help, turned it around for me completely.
Oh, that's great.
So I'm quite happy to have her as the boss.
So kits are an interesting thing for me and something interesting, but they're also something I tend to stay away from because I always feel like with a kit, I have to be careful with my thread use so I don't run out. How do you deal with that? Do you just put a lot of extra thread in or what do you do?
Okay, that's a very good question. There are a few ways that I deal with that. In some of our kits, because of the time element, we actually use whole skeins of threads and whole cards of silk ribbon. Not all of them. When I do a design, I have what I call my project box, the current project box, and I will take new skeins of thread, new cards of ribbon or whatever I'm using in that box. I'll work with it, and then I always add on more to allow for people that are beginners and new to it and maybe not don't save thread as much as they can because they don't know how. I also test my designs when I teach a class. For example, like now when I go to France, I've got one or two new designs going with me. And if the girls work with these designs, I monitor and see how it works out. I'd rather always add too much than too little because there's nothing worse. Over the years, I've probably had maybe a dozen, you know, people that have run out, we just pop an extra meter of thread or whatever it is in the post to them, whatever is needed to complete the design. But in theory, you shouldn't run out.
Okay, right. Because it's just for me, it's not that I'm sloppy with the thread. It's just I feel that pressure in the back of my mind to, you know, to not get careless at all because I might run out. So you obviously have that covered in your kits.
Well, as much as we can, we do, yes. But I try to make myself as open to my customers and students as is possible. If they need to get hold of me, if they experience any problems, to email tell me straight away. I mean, I think we're all in that position. I feel very strongly that if you purchase something, you must be able to say, I'm not happy with this, or I don't like it. In other words, you don't just buy a product and accept it for what it is. If it's not right, if it's not working out for you, to let the person know. It's no use complaining or not doing anything about it. So if somebody gets hold of me and says, I'm not happy with something, I will sort it out.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Well, yeah, it does. Yeah. It does, yeah. Yeah, just, I mean, that's just the thing I have about kits. And so I'm always curious. Obviously, you have that addressed quite well and are aware of it. Because hassle for you if someone has to have an extra length of thread just to finish something up. And
But it takes 2 seconds to pop that thread into the post. I mean, I never set out, when I first started teaching, I'm a fully trained high school teacher. So I taught for many years in high school prior to starting with embroidery. And when I started teaching embroidery, I never set out with the idea of making kits. And it was through demonstrating silk ribbon at shows, I was selling the product, in other words, and not a kit. And I would sit and demonstrate, and I would have customers watching me, and then they'd say to me, have you got a design? Have you got a kit for me to use? And I said, no, just go home. You know, if you take a book out the library or buy a book online or from your store, trace a design, copy it, and you could, you know, create your own little piece. But for a lot of people, that is very daunting. And I know from teaching in a class, you say to people, draw so-and-so, and immediately there's resistance because you'll find 70% maybe of people, even 80%, have no confidence in drawing at all. So what I did was I started with really, really simple silk ribbon kits that just had a couple of meters of silk ribbon in it, some needles, and I put a little card in so that they could insert the little design into a card. And I made a simple design. That's when I started in 2002. And the whole idea was that they could go off and comfortably practice and try something out. And that's how the kits grew. So I don't see the kits as something that you're going to do for the rest of your life. A kit would be a means to achieving the objective of learning a particular technique. And I feel the onus then would be on me to include enough product for them to achieve that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. All right, former teacher. I'm a former teacher too. Let's spend an hour telling teaching stories. How about that?
I gave up teaching children to teach adults. No, I loved it. I did love it. I taught for 7 years. I'm qualified as a high school teacher in PE and English, physical education and English. I majored at university in psychology and physical education. And taught PE for 7 years until I had my second son, and then I stopped. But I did love it. I thoroughly enjoyed it. But there's a vast difference in teaching school children who have to be there as opposed to adults who want to be there. I enjoy teaching adults. I mean, I enjoy teaching children. I've taught children embroidery as well. But again, they want to be there. So that's the difference, I think. And I just love that. I love the reward you get from seeing somebody who's never, for example, done silk ribbon embroidery suddenly cotton on to what it's all about and feel the confidence to actually carry on stitching on their own.
Yeah. Well, that's to me. I mean, I don't teach anymore, but that was for me teaching students in school to see that when the light goes on, there's nothing beats that. That's that's just a special moment. Some kids struggling and fighting to learn something, and then they catch on, and you go home feeling good that night. Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I'd love teaching, period. It doesn't matter whether it's children or adults. It's yeah. that reward that you get. It's a sense of achievement, satisfaction from seeing somebody else achieve as a result of your,
Right.
Yeah.
So, okay. So how did you get started doing the stitching? Just something you learned from your mother, or what are the origins of all of this?
My mum taught me to sew and to cook, but sew as in on a sewing machine. So I was proficient. By the time I was 12 years of age, I could cook a full meal, and I was sewing on her sewing machine, and she taught me to make clothes. But the once I left university, I actually started with crafts. I'd always loved doing crafts. We did a bit of handwork at school. And I enjoyed that side of it. So when I left school, university, I started off with pottery making. And then I went on to a folk art painting. And I sort of moved through quite a few crafts. And then I got involved with quilting and patchwork. And I loved that. I was very involved. We had a very strong guild in the town where I lived. And I was on the committee, and we had a group of about 120 of us that belonged to the guild. And then I went off to a quilting get-together, a massive conference down in Cape Town in South Africa, and I met Leslie Turpin-Delport, who was teaching embellishment and three-dimensional stitching on clothing. And I did a workshop with her, and I was absolutely hooked. Previously, what I'd been exposed to through my aunts and my mother-in-law was long and short silk shading, silk painting, embroidery, and it had no appeal for me, much as I thought it was beautiful. Personally, I didn't want to do it. But when I saw Leslie's work, I just fell in love with it, and I was instrumental in getting her to come and teach up in Port Elizabeth. And she suggested that I learn from her and become a franchise teacher for her.
Oh.
Which I did. So that's how I started. You're at school, you're teaching, as in children, and a lot of the staff knew I was doing the patchwork and quilting, and I'd been teaching them a little bit of shadow applique. And then when I started with the embroidery, they wanted me to teach them the embroidery as well. So I would be at school teaching, get home mid-afternoon, and then I'd teach a class at home in embroidery as well, and sometimes in the evenings. And eventually I couldn't cope with both. So I gave up school teaching and carried on with the handwork, and it just grew into, I had 80 odd students on a regular basis over a 2-week period. So I was running 11 classes back then.
Wow.
Yeah. So it was, I was lucky enough to have a studio, which was a room outside the house as well. And I could take up to 8 students at a time. So I did that, and it was my source of income. And then I relocated to, or emigrated to England back in 1999. And I got a job at the local sports centre for a while. But again, started actually at the suggestion of others importing embroidery products from South Africa. And that's how I started here in England. And that, again, grew. I was involved. I did big shows, which I still do. Mm-hmm. I've been doing them now for a long time, where I demonstrate. And the business grew once I got here. So I teach as well on a regular basis to embroiderers' guilds here. As I said, teach the odd class from home, and a couple of shops I teach at, and then travel to teach all over.
Yeah, no, you extended trips to – oh, go ahead, Christine.
I was going to say, what do you think you enjoy more, traveling, teaching, or teaching from home?
I wouldn't say I teach I prefer one over the other. I mean, I love teaching from home because obviously I've got everything to hand. I've got as many books as I want. I've got an extensive library of books. So you've got anything reference, you know, obviously that's all here. It's more personal, more intimate, because I only do four or five. I can't fit any more into the studio. But then you go away. I love traveling. Doesn't matter whether it's local in the UK or going abroad. I've always loved travel and the sense of adventures, and I enjoy both. I think they're quite different. Obviously, you've got to be well organized when you travel abroad and when you travel locally to make sure you've got everything. So I'm a little bit like the bag lady. I've got half a dozen carrier bags, which at some stage are almost too heavy to carry, and I take everything with me, from ribbons to threads to kits, books, so that I'm adequately prepared.
Yeah, you can't risk that shipping stuff ahead of time, can you? You need to make sure that you have it in your hands.
Yeah. The first year I taught in France on the Alpine Experiences, which is where I'm currently teaching, up near an hour from Geneva, up in the Alps, so it's just inside the French border. The first year I taught there, I was going to ship everything ahead. I packed it all up and put it in a crate, organized for them to pick it up. They failed to pitch. And then when I called them, they said, oh, they'd fetch it the next day. In the meantime, I'd been reading up on the news that there was a strike in France. So I sort of woke up in the middle of the night with this sort of eureka moment, thinking, if I send my kits en masse in a box ahead with all my teaching stuff, and it gets stuck in a strike in France, in the harbor, in the port, I won't have any product to teach. So I called them and they said, yes, that's what would happen. So it's put me off shipping stuff, because the French like to strike every summer over the holidays, which is the time that I teach. But yeah, so I've landed up actually taking it as extra baggage on board, you know, when I fly. But that's becoming so prohibitively expensive that it's not an option. So I'm going to have to go back to shipping and just be canny about it. Perhaps do it well in advance before vacation time, if vacation time is involved.
Yeah.
But I mean, I'm going, as you might know, I'm going across to the US at the end of the year to teach, and there we will ship everything.
So yeah, you'll have to.
Yeah. We'll, you know, ship it in lots, as it were, because some of it will go in advance so that the students can prepare in advance, and the rest will then follow so that they've got all the materials needed to stitch the project.
Yeah, that's got to be just nerve-wracking, though, because you're traveling abroad and you got to, you know, is my stuff going to be there when I need it? And, yeah, oh, man, I can't imagine that. Yeah.
Well, I mean, I was quite happy to take an extra suitcase on plane and just pay for it previously, but they've literally doubled the charges for that in the last year. So each way, for example, the suitcase now would have cost £60, the second suitcase. So what's that? $80 each way. Mm-hmm. That's quite a lot of money.
Right. Yeah, that's
sum up with, you know, it's worth it, basically.
Right. No, I agree. Yeah, it's anything you carry on planes anymore. I just did a trip with a discount airline, because I normally fly American, and because of where I had to go, I ended up on a discount airline where you pay for everything. And
yeah,
I know what you mean. They just nickeled and dimed me to death, and I just, you know, get me back to American Airline where I can fly like normal. But yeah,
it seems to be a trend, unfortunately, because even, you know, like British Airways is now using the same policy where you pay for your luggage.
Yeah.
So, because they're in competition against the cheaper airlines.
Right. Right.
And then, of course, the second suitcase, they're increasing the costs.
Oh, sure, because they can. Yes, exactly.
Mm.
Yeah.
Mm.
Okay, so what's the progression? When you're learning, because you do stump work, silk ribbon embroidery, crewel, what's the technique you started with, and what's the progression as you've gone through the years? Just different interests that have come up, or how do you acquire so many skills?
Okay. Right. Leslie Turpendahl-Port covered a variety of techniques. So when she trained me and taught me, we learned the basics, first of all, of embroidery, working with crewel stitches, three-dimensional stitches. She taught a wide variety, a number of stitches. She also taught me to paint on fabric. She taught me stump work techniques, silk ribbon techniques, crazy patchwork stitches, not so much the crazy patch. The crazy patch I got more from being a quilter, and enjoyed that aspect of it. So I learned a lot of the skills initially. And then, like anything in life, you go through and you find what you like and what you don't like. And I gave a talk one day here in England, and one lady very wisely said to me, a well-known teacher herself, she said to me afterwards at the end of the talk, you need to concentrate on one area of you, you know, that appeals to you. You've got too many diverse interests. And at that stage, I just started teaching small designs on pincushions. So I thought, right, I can still do everything then, but I'll do them on the pincushions. So it's enough. So I still get to do my stump work and crazy patch and all of that. I do find it very hard. If I had to pick one, very hard. Very. Yeah. I could pick two, maybe. But it would be very difficult. So I've done a little bit of gold work as well, which I enjoy, and the challenge of that, I'd like to do more of that, but not to teach myself, simply for myself, for self-satisfaction.
Mm-hmm. Well, maybe that's part of it, is that you keep some of those things just for you, you know? They don't have to be teaching items.
Absolutely, yeah. Otherwise, you do go crazy. I mean, it's difficult enough trying to put all the designs in the different embroidery types
right.
together into kits, for example, or packs for teaching. So I would definitely not want to add gold work to that, much as I love it. The component parts, you know, are so many and so varied. It would be much more difficult.
Yeah, that's a technique that intrigues me, that whole gold work thing. That looks like a lot of fun and a really, really good challenge.
Yeah.
It is. Yeah, it is. Very much so. I thoroughly enjoyed it. I did City and Guilds Level 1 with Tracy Franklin, who's a well-known teacher here in England. And she's both City and Guilds trained and RSN trained. So the course she delivered was absolutely brilliant. I'm just waiting for her to write Level 2 and Level 3. She actually wrote the course herself for them, for City and Guilds. And then maybe I'll carry on doing that for myself.
So you do, unlike a lot of people who do what you do, and if I can use do more in a sentence, I'll do it. But you apparently get to do a little personal stitching, something just for your personal enjoyment then.
Oh, not
Oops,
much.
Maybe not.
No. If it's for my personal enjoyment, it'll be something completely different. I'll give you an example. I did a course last year with Laura McCabe, who's a beading teacher from the US, and it was an embroidery beading, she advertised it as beaded embroidery, but it's beading in its fullest sense, in that you're making a flower, individual items, and then attaching them to fabric.
Okay.
So it's not beaded embroidery in the sense of where you're actually incorporating beads into your stitches on directly onto the fabric. So it's completely different. But I absolutely loved that. I thoroughly enjoyed it. I haven't finished it, needless to add, because I haven't got time. But, you know, that's the sort of thing I would do for myself.
Okay.
And maybe go back to watercolor painting. That's what I would love to do.
So that's the kind of thing where painting, for example, gives you a chance to just get away from stitching and refresh your mind.
Well, I think painting is and obviously drawing is an integral part of design work anyway. I used to actually go for watercolor lessons once a week. And I loved it because it was time to get away and just not be involved with the business. But I haven't had that time in the last few years. I've just found an painting teacher near me, and I'm hoping to attend classes with her once I've finished writing my book. But the drawing and the painting, I love doing it because I think the more you draw, obviously the better you get. But the painting, I would like to be painting in my work as well, incorporating actual watercolors into my work. I do use watercolors onto fabric. I have in some of my designs, and I'm going to work on some pieces next year once the book's finished, where I'm taking the watercolors and painting on fabric, and then I'm going to do stump work and ribbon work and combination of textured stitches into it. So that's my next challenge. That's why I'm very keen to go back to painting.
Oh, okay.
How would you incorporate the watercolor into the stitchery?
Okay, when you're painting watercolors, there are two methods techniques that you use. You either paint what's called wet onto dry, so your background paper fabric is dry, and then you add paint, which tends then to be less impressionistic. The other method is the wet into wet. So you wet your fabric first, or you wet your paper first, and then you take your watercolors and you feed the paint, and of course it spreads. And that's what I love. So I want to go back to wetting a piece, maybe wetting part of it, maybe just a combination of both techniques. So you'd roughly sketch your design using a pencil onto the fabric. I'd paint into that then. You can do it either way. You can, if you just want a totally neutral background, say various shades of greens, you could just paint your whole background first, then iron it dry, then work with your pencil into it. You could bring ink into it as well, but you'd have to use a Pigma pen, something that's permanent, and then work stitches into that.
That sounds really amazing. I love the textural aspect of it by combining different media.
Yeah, that's what I'm dying to get stuck into. when you go up into the Alps, the scenery is just fantastic, and the flowers and the trees that are lying broken and the bark. And so, there's a lot of inspiration there. Again, to get back to that thing called time, it's when you're able to fit it all in.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. What is this teaching in the Alps? Is this a school? What gets you there?
They found me. I was just very lucky. 4 years ago, I think it is now. It's a company called the Alpine Experience, and what they were doing initially only was in the winter time. They would run, they host skiing trips. But then the lady at the time who was running it, Jackie, she did a lot of craft herself, and she decided she wanted to see the chalets working in the summer as well as the winter, so that they were bringing income in the summer as well. Oh. So she hit on the idea of inviting various teachers to come and teach different crafts. And it's just been a fantastic success. She has a variety from beading, lace making, They've even got a textile teacher there doing a freestyle textiles. And so we go, it's run in the form of a retreat. So you're there for 8 to 10 days and all meals are included and you just sit and stitch and I teach. So I have plus minus eight to 10 students. And they are just looked after 100%. And, they get to stitch all day and we go on trips as well out, to nearby towns, or we've been up Mont Blanc. I've just had my first trip up a ski lift. Never been up one before. That we did last month in July. So it's proved to be a very successful venture, and the ladies just love it, and they keep coming back.
Well, that's just a miserable existence. I can't.
Yeah, I know. It's hard, isn't it?
Yeah, way to suffer. Yeah.
Yeah, that's. I do get teased. And, of course, I'm doing it twice this year and twice next year. So I get a lot of teasing about that. You know, really hard life you have teaching.
Yeah, yeah.
But I am teaching. I do teach for the entire time. And the girls can, you know, can bug me any time of the day, you know, for help, even when it's, you know, when it's quiet time or, you know, we're not stitching. I'm always about.
Sounds like a good time to me. Yep.
I'm curious about the book that you've been mentioning.
The book is going to be called Embroidered Country Gardens. This started off probably 15 odd years ago. I met one of the editors at Search Press, and she used to pop across to my stand every year at the show, and she'd come and say, "When are you going to write a book?" And I'd say to her, "Rosalie, I'm not ready to write a book. I'm not experienced enough." And this has gone on for years, and she just arrives at my stand, and she would stand in front of me and look at me, and I'd say, "Next year, next year." And then last year she came to my stand. She just stood there again with the same look on her face. And I said, "Okay, you're on. I'll do it." I think she nearly fell over. Anyway, long story short, it's gone ahead. I had to put a proposal, obviously, forward to the publishers. You know, Search Press is very big here. I'm not sure how big it is in the States. But they do all the arts and crafts books, basically, in the UK. They're one of the biggest publishers for arts and crafts books. And they accepted my proposal. So I've got a year and a half to get it all together. Well, it's got to be ready by June next year. So I am working on a series of projects to go into the book. It's not totally project related. The idea being that I teach people a variety of different three-dimensional stitches and teach them through simple ways of creating their own garden. So they can start off learning to stitch, say, for example, daffodils, and then they can go on to stitching tulips and then learn how to put them in and create their own little piece with the two combined. So I'm doing a lot of drawings of individual elements, and then through a series of drawings, I will show them how you can combine the various flowers and create your own garden.
I love this idea.
Christine just pre-ordered.
Yeah, pretty much. Pretty much. I've been very much, looking at a lot of flower embroidery lately, and actually in photography, that's usually my subject matter as well. So, so I will be waiting for this. And I like the idea that you're using sort of floral motifs as a way of teaching different techniques, because again, you're going back to the resenting and resisting the idea that you have to pick a niche. So you're picking a motif and then using all of the different techniques. So you've done the same thing as with the pincushions again. So I applaud that resistance.
I suppose you could say it is like that. I'm trying to also show them how to, for example, if you took a foxglove you can interpret it 3 or 4 different ways with different stitches. Mm-hmm. So it's to show them that not only can they do the flower different ways, but they can also combine the flowers. And they can, if they want to, there'll be enough drawings in the book to trace themselves. Yeah. They don't have to do their own. But it, what I'm hoping to do is encourage people to, first of all, learn to stitch and not see stitching, real embroidery, as people so often call it, that it's not something that's not achievable, that it's totally right. achievable if they do one flower and just create one simple little element first. And then they can go on to combining them to create a garden. If they can't, they can copy. I'll have enough in there for them as well to copy. But the idea is not really behind the book is not to copy as such. It's more
right.
create your own, hence the Embroidered Country Gardens. I actually wanted to call the book Create Your Own Garden, but they decided that the Embroidered Country Gardens was a better route to go.
I like the idea too that you're talking about that there's different ways to stylistically represent the same subject matter. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you think of a rose and you always think of the same rose, but there's so many different ways of going about creating that. Like you said, you know, before from a watercolor way to if you went to a pencil and paper way, you know, I mean, I'm looking, so we've talked about my tattoo often. I have English country flowers, funnily
yes.
enough. And I have a friend who has exactly the same flowers worked through a tattoo, but they're done in a different style. So when
right.
you look at the two tattoos, they don't look anything alike, even yeah. though they have exactly the same floral subject matter.
Yeah.
So, and then it's fun to sort of compare and contrast how the same artist took the same material. And by using, you know, in one case, very much an etching style, and in the other case, more of a watercolor style, the same flower looks completely different and equally beautiful.
Yes, absolutely. Example I can give now, I had one of the ladies that was with me in France. She took my needle case, which is a little country garden scene, and she changed it all from the perlite threads that I designed and worked with, and she wanted to work with stranded cotton, and she wanted single strand, and she wanted all totally pastel colors. So she created this really pretty little garden that looked 100% different to mine, but the
right.
idea was there, and that's exactly mm-hmm. My goal is behind the book.
I the other thing that's great about that too is that you've talked about how people are afraid of starting from scratch, and I can certainly identify with that because I'm not an illustrator by any means. But this gives you sort of a baby step. You know, you give them the start, and now you take that and interpret it. So interpreting something that someone has already created is a lot less intimidating than starting from scratch, I think. So I think you sort of lead people along the path of realizing that they themselves are able to create these things by showing them in these small steps that they've already done it. They just didn't know that they were doing
yeah.
it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you've summed it up perfectly.
Yeah, that's going to be great.
As long as I get it finished in time.
Well, I'll be waiting. So you already have somebody waiting. So now you have to finish.
One soul. Yep.
I've been, a lot of my friends and students have pushed me for a long time to write a book. So, and I feel I'm at the stage of my life now where I'm ready to do it. Mm-hmm. And I want to do it. And I think that's probably what's the most important. Is the wanting to do it.
Yes, agreed.
Well, but it's stage of your life where you're ready to do it. I mean, I think that speaks volumes. You're comfortable writing and helping people learn with a book. You have to be comfortable with your own skills and experience and talent to put that into a book. That's 'cause that's, you know, once it's in a book, that's pretty permanent. So,
absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I obviously write instructions for all my kits, all the time. So the writing as such doesn't faze me. it's just a case of organizing my thoughts so that it's 100% yes. clear on paper and it's not too prescriptive. But the challenge at the moment is getting all the stitching done because it's very fine work. It takes a lot of time to do. It's not like silk ribbon, which is very quick to work with. I'm not using silk ribbon in the book at all. It's only worked with threads, stranded cottons or perlays, whatever you like. I've got a few simple stump work techniques going into it, but there won't be any stump work as such in it at all. So yes, it's my time is totally and utterly taken up with the stitching because I have to stitch the cover of the book. I have to each and every flower has to be stitched individually as a sample for photography. So which is obviously not a project. So that's just two massive pieces of fabric, and I'm doing each and every individual flower in 4-inch squares on the fabric. So it's a lot of work.
Yeah, that's the trouble with these kinds of books is you can't just put a bunch of words on paper and turn it in. You gotta
No. I think in many ways, I've got to be careful what I say here. I think a technique book, any book, be it art, be it woodworking, whatever. You are teaching people and your methods have to be 100% accurate.
Yes.
When you write a story, it's completely different. You're not teaching anybody.
Right.
As such, you may be getting an idea across, but it's your interpretation. You see where I'm coming from?
Well, see, that was what I was trying to get to with my statement about having to be comfortable within yourself to even do the book is exactly that. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Because if people get frustrated trying to accomplish from the book, then it's not a success. So you have to know going in that, yes, you can explain it and illustrate it and demonstrate it exactly. Yes.
Yeah. Well, I mean, writing the instructions for my kids for so many years, it's just a case of elaborating on that. I've got all the content from years and years of doing it now, but it's to put it into a book format so that it's and it must be a good form of reference for anybody wanting to work with it.
I need some help. Stump work.
Okay, yes.
Christine and I have both purchased books. We've rambled on about doing stump work. In preparation for this, I actually did some serious study. It seems intimidating to me, and I'm hesitant because I'm not really sure where to jump in. Are there tips you can offer to someone who's never done it that gets me? I'll be the guinea pig. Gets me over the hump in terms of because it just seems like to bend wire and to stitch basically in space and have it look like a leaf. I mean, just to me, getting wire into the shape of a leaf seems like I can just see it look like a kindergartner type thing. What can get me over the hump so that I can dive in?
Right. Stump work consists of a variety. There are a number of different methods used in this traditional form of embroidery. So you've got bead covering, for example, covering wooden beads. You've got padded and raised work. You've got your wired work, raised and textured stitches. And I think if you look at each one and just try and isolate individual elements and start off with the ones that are the simplest for you first. So, for example, when I teach a stump worker a beginner one-day workshop, I will teach them to cover a bead. If we take an acorn, for example, that's an easy one to start. So they cover an oval bead. Then I teach them a little bit of needle lace, which is a detached chain essentially, and they work a little cap onto the bead. When they finish that, that in itself is just a total sense of achievement.
Yeah, okay.
I think you, So if you do a little piece of padded work, for example, and you follow the instructions in whatever kit or book you're working with, provided they're clearly explained. I mean, there are particular ways, there are set ways that you would do it, say with felt or a bit of stuffing or whatever, and then cover it with your stitches. There are excellent books out there. My main source of reference has always been Jane Nicholas, who's Australian. Her books are absolutely outstanding. I've got no hesitation in recommending them at all. She's a fantastic stitcher, and certainly has been a source of inspiration for me. And she does break, as I've just said, down into individual elements. So she has, her books have the individual elements listed first before there are any projects in it. Mm-hmm. So you could set out to learn each one. But it's understanding. I mean, it is a completely different technique to other forms of embroidery. So you've got to sort of separate that thought in your head, as it were, that I'm not doing silk painting, for example. I'm actually, if I'm using long and short stitch or satin stitch into my leaf, it's going to have maybe a wire, it's going to have wire in it. And you've got, you don't just stitch freehand into the air, as you said, Gary. You actually have a needle pad that you work on. Alternatively, you can put a piece of fabric into a hoop, and then you would tack a piece I use artist tracing paper, which is quite a stiff tracing paper. You tack a piece of that into position, and then you, on that piece of paper, you can draw your shape of your leaf, mm-hmm. and then you tack your wire into position along that shape, and then you stitch onto it. So you're actually holding a hoop, or you can do the same thing onto a needle pad, which is just basically like a sandwich of fabric it's firm enough. Instead of working in a hoop, but it's more pliant to work with. But you are working with a base. You do have something to work on and to hold.
Okay, you just got me over the biggest hump right there, because I thought I had to sit and, in my hands, form a wire shape and then stitch with it. Oh, okay, that helps.
You will bend the piece of wire, maybe around a pen or a pencil or over the side of the blunt side of your scissors and get the shape, the point, whichever, or squash it gently with the pliers. But the actual shape you will mold on your paper background. So you will follow the outline that you've drawn on the paper background, and you will tack the wire to that outline that you've drawn. So it's if you've got a good book to work with, and you just go at it slowly, just make a individual little elements first, trying to do a big design.
Right. That's what we'd planned to do, and the Jane Nicholas books were sort of how we got started. So I bought one of her more advanced books and then said, whoa, this is way.
No, just go back. She's got two. She wrote two. The Beginner's Guide, and then the second one was a project book. And then the publishers actually combined them, and it's now sold in one.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So it would be the first half of the combined book. Is what I, you know, it's just an excellent source of reference.
It is.
I mean, there are other very, very good books out there as well. There's, depending on your style again, Jane Nicholas's style appeals to me, but the another set of books that I have, they if you can find them, are Raised Embroidery and New Designs in Raised Embroidery by Barbara and Roy Hurst, who are a British couple. She passed away a few years back, and they had an exhibition of her work at one of the shows up in London. But the books are excellent, but very more along the lines of traditional stump work, as in back in the 17th century, mm-hmm. With her figures. She does a lot. The two of them did a lot of figures and little scenes, farm scenes. So quite traditional, whereas Jane Nicholas tends to do more the elements of nature.
Yes.
Her fruit, mm-hmm. and her berries and her insects, her butterflies. But it's just, and then there's, you've got other, there are loads of other good teachers, you know, other good books out there for beginners as well.
I just want a pansy. I just want a simple pansy.
Well, Jane Nicholas has got lots of pansies in her book.
He does. Yeah. And I think that's what drew me to the stump work to begin with, was really her designs that were, you know, especially the insects are exquisite. And then it was, okay, what do I need to do to learn how to do this technique to be able to create that? So it, for me, it was the opposite way. It wasn't a, I want to learn this technique and then, you know, what will I make with it? It was, these designs are just stunning. So what do I need to learn in order to be able to do them?
Yeah, I think it's just, you know, keep it simple. That's what I'd mm-hmm. say to, mm-hmm. to anybody, any advice if I was going to give anybody. Don't try and do a whole, you know, a whole selection of flowers and berries and fruits and butterflies and bees. Just do right. one simple little, like your pansy. Start off with that. Concentrate on just stitching a pansy.
That's all I want. That's just all I want is one pansy.
Well, get going.
You can do it, Gary.
Yeah, I'm sure you can.
Okay. All right. Well, that helps with the wire, because that was one of the things I was struggling with, was how do we shape a wire so it looks like something? So, all right, that helps. We're running out of time here, but I got you made a comment about silk ribbon embroidery. And how quick it is, or mm-hmm. relatively, I was surprised to hear that, because it looks rather involved to me.
Silk ribbon embroidery is a bit of contradiction in terms, because I always say to people, you've got to be gentle, slow, careful, and manipulate the ribbon. So the two words I always use are manipulate and be gentle. Mm-hmm. But because it's a broad element, the actual ribbon itself covers a large, far larger area. For example, if I was stitching a little woven rose in thread, it would take me 10 times as long as if it was with silk ribbon. You can finish a reasonably large project in a day or two. If I was doing that in thread, it would take me weeks. So it is much quicker because the ribbon's broader. You're making bigger flowers or smaller flowers, but you still achieve that the effect very quickly with one stitch. Whereas a leaf, for example, in using threads may take you an hour, whereas to get the shape of the leaf. Whereas with the silk ribbon, it's just one stitch and you've got it. Mm-hmm. So I do love it. I love working with it. It's one of those things I always say, you either get the feel for it or you don't. It can look very unattractive if it's not well done.
Okay.
Careful how I put this. It's a beautiful, I absolutely love it. If it's beautifully done, it is such an attractive form of embroidery. But I think with a lot of people, maybe they try it and they don't master it straight away, because you can't pull threads like you pull when you're working with cottons. You will pull them fairly firmly to create something, but with silk ribbons you can't. The minute you pull too firmly, you lose the shape. Mm-hmm. And it's a different technique altogether to working with threads, but it certainly is not a difficult technique. Piece I've just finished stitching. In fact, this morning I laced it up. I've used the one stitch throughout the entire design, which is ribbon stitch or inverted stab stitch, depending on which way you want to refer to it. And all I've done is I've taken the one stitch and I've created daffodils, tulips, crocuses, grape hyacinths and hyacinths. And I've done a little spring time, as I've called it, a little scene, but I've used one stitch, and it's just the shaping of that one stitch that gives you that variety of flowers. So what I'm trying to do with that design is encourage people to practice a bit. I think, to get back to what I first started saying, is they give up too quickly. It's practice. The more you do it, the better you get at it. It's like anything mm-hmm. in life. It is very achievable. And it is reasonably quickly done. And it's also easy on the eye, big needles. So an older person who might battle to see to thread a very fine crewel needle won't battle as much with a silk ribbon needle, which is we call a chenille needle.
Yeah.
Same as a tapestry, but it's got a sharp point. So it creates a hole in the fabric, you know, to pull the ribbon through.
Right. Ah, okay. That seems – because it really does – like your designs, it looks like – an awful a lot of work and talent and skill, which you have obviously, but to pull those off. But it sounds from your description as if with a little practice you can. It's pretty straightforward then.
Yes, absolutely. That is my goal, to make it as simple. I want people to stitch. I want young people to stitch. I get very excited when I have young school kids come up at a show and say, "Oh wow, that looks fantastic! I'd love to try it." That's what I want. I want to see embroidery, young people enjoying and doing it, putting it on their clothing, whatever makes them happy, but so that we don't lose the art.
Yes, that's so important. Yes. All right, Lorna, we have to stop. I hate that, but yeah. There's a ton more questions. So that means you have to come back sometime. So
yes, please.
Oh, I'd love to. That would be absolutely great. I'm hopefully, I always say this, but at some stage, maybe later this year, get as far as doing short little filmed scenes of or me stitching and just simplify maybe a few stump work techniques, a bit of silk ribbon and some of the more difficult textured stitches, and just put a few little excerpts up online.
I'll watch.
I think that would be tremendously helpful. Yeah, because then you can actually see it. There's so much more value to being able to see how a ribbon goes through
Absolutely.
The fabric, right? And how it gets laid down and sort of what tension you're working with. I think that would be great.
Yeah, because seeing somebody do it is far easier than just reading it in a book. Well, it's been great. Thank you. Thank you for the invitation.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for the time, and thanks to everyone for listening, and we'll be back Wednesday with just Christine and me. So thanks.
Yes. Take care.